I'd like to introduce our guest speaker today. Nabil has an amazing background doing this work, and we are so excited to have this conversation today. He qualified as an architect at the Architectural Association in London in 1968. He worked for the Greater London Council between 1969 and 1978, where his award-winning housing projects established his reputation in participatory design and planning. From 1981 to 1990, he was assistant and then associate professor of housing at MIT in Massachusetts, where he was later awarded a Ford International Career Development Professorship. In 1997, Nabil won the UN Habitat Scroll of Honor for his work on community action planning. He founded the Master's Course in Development Practice at Oxford Brookes University in 1992, which was awarded the Queen's Anniversary Prize for Higher and Further Education in 2001, a wonderful honor. He was awarded an honorary doctorate from the University of Pretoria, South Africa in 2008, and he's currently Professor Emeritus at Oxford Brookes University and Teaching Fellow at the Development Planning Unit at University College in London. He was until recently an AREP Fellow at the University of Cape Town and an Adjunct Professor at the National University of Technology in Trondheim, Norway. He's consulted on participatory action planning all around the world, involving also the upgrading of slums and cities to all major international development agencies and to charities and NGOs worldwide. He's the author of the book Small Change, also published by EarthScan, Housing Without Houses, Making Micro Plans and Action Planning for Cities. He's also editor of the collected volumes Educating for Real and Urban Futures. Nabil, thank you so much for spending time with us today to tell us about your exciting work.
Thank you for inviting me, Beth.
Well, Nabil, the place I'd like to start is in terms of talking about the Placemaker's Guide to Building Community is, could you tell us a little bit about how you define placemaking and what role that played in conceptualizing this book?
Sure, Beth. I think it may be best for me to sort of state the three assumptions that drove it all very much in relationship to placemaking. And I suppose the first, in response to anyone involved in the built environment, is very much about the scope and purpose of practice, at least so far as placemaking is concerned. And what it suggests is that if we are to engage effectively, when I say we, I mean these days all of us, architects, planners, engineers, anyone involved in the built environment, if we're to engage effectively in some of the global issues these days that we face, that we all face, I think, in cities, issues of poverty, the loss of cultural identity induced by globalization, climate change, and the rest, then we have to change the scope and purpose of practice. We have to, in other words, add more strategic value to our practical interventions in cities. And in that sense, place begins to make space for enterprise, social development, social integration, and the rest of it. I suppose the second assumption behind the book, which I explore in its various sections, is about the life and organization of place. And it's about the way in which very ordinary people, every day, and we all know that, overcome the limitations they face, and especially at the poorest levels, by so-called hacking into, and I like that phrase, it was coined quite recently by Scott Burnham, hacking into housing, services, utilities, and improvising, the ability to actually make things happen in a very improvised way, adapting, using trial and error, what Richard Sennett calls improvisation, he calls the user's art, which I must say I quite like. And the assumption really goes on and says, or suggests at least, that when design and planning, when it comes to placemaking, becomes the sole domain of experts, all this street-level intelligence and creativity gets lost. And what we get instead is sort of, I don't know, I kind of like to call it an architecture of compliance, where people are relegated at best to caretakers of the built environment. And the third assumption, which I suppose places placemaking, is about the nature of our own interventions as experts. It's about the way we work. And it suggests that if you want to do something big, it's the small change initiative, really. Then you start with something small and you start where it counts. And that shifts us off of the big plan idea, not that I deny the importance of that, and more onto the idea of a catalyst, something to get something going, something that actually starts a bigger process off. And I would like to think ourselves almost as like urban acupuncturist in a way, you know, trying to find that spot in place where you can release, prick it as it were, and release the energy of place so that it can fix itself. And for me, that's a common sense assumption and is rooted and grounded, I suppose, in the theories of action science and action planning, which have shaped my work throughout. Rather a long explanation of the place of placemaking, but I hope at least that sets the scene, Beth.
Oh, I think that's fantastic. I mean, there are so many pieces there that you've just highlighted that I think just resonate with those of us who do this kind of work.
Great.
And so I'd like to start with the third one first that you mentioned,
yeah.
Talking about
sure.
examining our own interventions and thinking about making small changes and serving as the catalyst. What is it do you see that's part of the practice today that takes us away from that very human, natural focus on the relationships and get, you know, the orientation that's more placed on, you know, an expert knowledge versus kind of the community knowledge?
I think it's various things, actually, and I'd love people's response on this, obviously. It's various things, and I think in the first place, one of the reasons that we seem to be, at least over here in the UK and in Europe generally, making such little progress despite the talk, is that our own very often professional expertise and status is threatened. What is it, as it were, that suggests after a long education and an expensive one that I've had and all the professional roles that one's played, that suggests that we need to engage with people in an ordinary way and get their ideas about it? If you want a house, I can design you a house without any problem at all. You want a master plan? I'll do it for you. I was very trained in that. And that's, I think, one of the first real barriers to our intervening in the small change catalyst way. Secondly, I think the process that we adopt is very much delegated by our own expectations of what we're supposed to achieve. I am paid, if I'm paid, happily I'm not paid too often, to deliver a plan. And I have a timetable, there's a beginning and a middle and an end to it. And I'm getting in the development business, how can you call an end to a process that's ongoing? And a process in which very often I believe it's a privilege that I've joined, as it were, not started off or finished off and so on. And in that respect, one has to come away from the idea that the old Geddes idea, I suppose, is that you survey, you analyze, you plan, implement, and actually reverse that order. You do something first, think about it a bit, then, of course, it gets analyzed and so on, and the larger plan appears. And I think, again, that's a very unfamiliar way of working. So I think it's those two things dominantly. And I think, thirdly, our own professional institutes, I know my students in architecture and urban design, certainly, as soon as we start talking more strategically about our practical interventions, and here I go back to the old John Turner quote, where he said once, what a house does is probably as important, if not more important, than what it is. We're very good at what it is. I can design you a house in minutes. But what it does engages me in things that are not part of architecture. What it does in terms of generating employment, improving health, raising status, building identity, all kinds of things like that begin to move me away from my traditional role as architect. So I have the professional institutes coming in very often and going, yes, that's a very interesting project, but is it really architecture? And I do remember the wonderful anthropologist, Lisa Peetie at MIT, attending one of our architectural conferences, those ones that we have every 3 or 4 years in which we try and establish and think about the legitimacy and purpose of architecture. I remember her standing up and saying, well, you can carry on talking about this for the rest of time, or you can stop and just be relevant. And that really shifted me very much to thinking about moving on. But it's a big barrier. As soon as we move out of our professional discipline, it looks like we need to be somebody else. And that's another issue to talk about.
Well, in going to your second point, I mean, I just love the examples that you brought into the book, talking about really honoring the life and organization of a place. And you use this phrase from a colleague, you know, trying to make a place, any place, a wonderful place to grow up in, which I thought was very cool. And also the importance of making people the core focus of any particular project. And that's kind of very different than what generally is emphasized in a lot of international development projects. And so I guess as we think about that second point you made about honoring that and providing a means to support people to hack into services and improve their community, Could you expand on that a little bit and maybe share an example or two from the book? There were
great ways. Yeah, I think the first part of that, you're absolutely right. It was Colin Ward, in fact, who wonderfully, I think, he was quoting a friend, in fact, when he was asked what makes a good neighborhood. He could have, of course, easily said improved traffic, accessible housing, better playgrounds for kids, clear up the garbage. And, of course, he would have been right on all of those counts. But instead, you're absolutely right, he said, a good neighborhood is a wonderful place to grow up in. And that, of course, is the qualitative way in which anyone can understand. And that includes issues of security and identity and the rest of it. So I think that's a key part of it. But out of, I think, that understanding of place comes the thinking of how we fit into the creation of a wonderful place to grow up in, as it were. And here, I think we have to be a little humbled when it comes to your second point about putting people at the center. And I tend not to, as I did once upon a time in the old activist days, in the good old late 60s, early 70s, as it were, argue for power to the people. I'm really now very much concerned about the pragmatics of partnering up with organizations who know as much as I do, but in a different area, and accessing that resource. And so actually, it's quite a sort of selfish position that I take. It's the partnership position. They've got something that I need in order to make something work. So I'm not doing any good. I'm not doing anybody any favors here. It's just that we need to get together and make places work. But importantly, I think what is so difficult is that it just does change the view of the expert, as it were. And I love the quote that went, we tend to see ourselves, experts, as special kind of people, which we are. But until we see everybody out there as a special kind of expert as well, then we will deny the incredible resources out there that can make things happen and can change things and can sustain things. And I think there are lots of wonderful examples of that, not least is the example that I give in, I think, one of my early chapters of the Women's Bank in Sri Lanka, which started off as a series of very small, what we call thrift societies, 10 members, women, collecting something like 10 cents a month, and then using that money to buy food and the rest. Three or four or five, it grew to something like that, groups. Those groups then were constituted as a bank in, I think, around 1983. Started, as I say, with three groups, became 15, 7, 22. It's now 6,000 groups, 60,000 members, there's 100 branches, $7 million worth of turnover. But what is really interesting about that example is that it started incredibly small. As its impact grew, so the units of organization remained small. In other words, you scale up the impact, you've got to scale down at the same time the units of organization to keep it accountable and accessible and so on. But that was a very, very small change, which recognized by a few, inspirational people who said, look, we can really federate these banks together, these small groups together, and create a bank for the benefit of all. And so that was a small intervention with inspirational people, some of the formal banks. It was obviously recognized by government, but that's the support they needed. They didn't need any big routines as such. So lots of really wonderful examples like that of very small-scale things becoming big with some outside help, clearly, but at the same time remaining small-scale in accountability and organization.
Well, and to build on that, I mean, I'm thinking about the example that you use that has to do with the buffalo named Betty, which I thought was just a great story. And
yeah. And
as part of that, you highlighted these kind of three aspects of building community, the emphasis on enterprise, I mean, like you were talking about with the bank, partnerships, which were, you know, are so critical to supporting people being able to make those improvements themselves rather than us making them for them. And the social learning of that. Could you address that and kind of talk a little bit about those three pieces and why you feel they're central to that idea of building community?
Absolutely. And I think those three, really. I mean, I think the first, the enterprise one. Well, let me just back off a little bit, and I think this concept of community needs to be a little bit unraveled, and I've understood from all the various anthropological debates and so on, that is clearly not a homogeneous entity that we deal with very often. There are communities of practice where people get together around work, communities of culture, communities of place where people share place, communities of interest, which is, I can give you a very good example of that through my book with the Pierre Bus. Communities of resistance, largely displaced communities as a result of conflict or natural disaster, all have different definitions. And so I think, first of all, a good understanding of what it is that we're dealing with when we're talking about enterprise partnerships, participation, and so on. In each of those cases, certainly, I talk about building community through that first, as you mentioned, enterprise, and largely through social enterprise. In other words, through both collective understanding of the benefit of federating small units, whether it's through bringing people together, as I give an example, and running a cooperative kitchen as part of a tourist homestay, or indeed the kind of social enterprise, as I've just mentioned, which is what it is, in the Women's Bank, and so on. The importance of enterprise is it gets us off of this idea that people are engaged because of their goodwill, because of the fact that they have some ideological intent there. And there may be some ideology, but enterprise is about being practical. Enterprise is about building livelihoods. And at the end of the day, it's livelihoods that are central to building community, defined in all sorts of ways. The sustainable livelihoods model, which is building up not just physical and financial assets, but social assets, political assets, all that it takes, as it were, to be engaged, to be involved. So I think that's the first one, the enterprise model. But the second one, yes, is partnerships. And partnerships is a key part, of course, of this whole debate on good governance, that relationship between, in generic terms, the state, I suppose, the market and civil society. Enterprise demands partnerships, and it's not just partnerships public and private like in the old days, because that's too abstract. It's partnerships between formal and informal private organizations, partnerships between different levels of government, and being able to experiment and explore new partnerships that open new doors between, for example, community contracting, waste collecting organizations with more formal garbage collection organizations, and so on. So partnerships is a key, and of course, central to the partnership debate is the participation discussion. And then social learning, in the sense, I mean, I like the term social learning because it's learning that comes out of interacting. It's learning that is mutual. It's not learning by going to school necessarily, but it's learning from experience. It's learning through the act of doing with others. And that collective understanding of what works and what doesn't is, I suppose, the most profound kind of learning. It's the sort of referred to as the practical wisdom of place, which is often difficult to define. No better example that I can give than in the city of Sana'a in Yemen, in which wonderful buildings, wonderful pieces of architecture are put up entirely by narrative through the learning that takes place from the apprentice and the sort of master builder. But no drawings, nothing like that. The guy just tells the story and the builder builds. And it's only through social learning, through the interaction of time and people, that I think that level of understanding and that level of craft and skill develops. So yes, those three things are absolutely key to the building community aspect. And I can give you lots of examples. I think one from the book, you mentioned the Buffalo example, but certainly the Pierre de Bus, which I like, this constant and forever problem that we have of how to get the kids to school. Easy to say, get the buses in, which is what we all talk about. But unfortunately, most of the areas that I work in, you've got tiny little narrow streets, buses can get nowhere near the houses. And so it's the women, and generally it is the women, have to spend 2 hours of the day taking and walking the kids to school. And I remember sitting in one community event, talking for endlessly, we must try and get the buses in, which means widening the streets, moving people. An incredibly complex process emerged. And somebody at the back of the room went, why are we constantly talking about getting the buses in? We should be talking about getting the kids out. And in the case that I give in the book, the local authority hired essentially 15 bus drivers, except they didn't drive buses. They walked the kids to school. And we did it in a way so that they walked occasionally in different routes. As they walked, they began to understand place. They crossed boundaries to other areas of the neighborhood that were slightly they felt threatened about. Each group, there were six groups of children, one walker, bus driver, as it were, to every about 15 children, selected one member who sat on a children's neighborhood planning committee. And they debated all sorts of things, like how their uniform got dirty when they went to school, we need to clean up this, that, and the other. And then every 6 months, they all selected one person to sit on the Community Development Council. So there again, a very practical issue of getting the kids to school with a very strategic agenda that I had of how can you engage kids in neighborhood management. And they really were, in that sense, a community of interest. That's what the children were, apart from, of course, belonging also to community of place and the community of culture. So lots of examples of that. So it was enterprise. There were lots of partnerships there between the public authority and the community groups, and social learning in the sense that the children learned through interaction. They learned school started before you got to school.
Wow. That is a wonderful example. I mean, it really touches on all three elements of the idea of building community. I'd like to now go to the first point that you made, where you talk about adding more strategic value. And in the book, Nabil, you talk about kind of two different approaches, one community action planning and the second strategic action planning. Can you just give us a little thumbnail for how you describe both of them? I know some people on the call are planners and others are engagement experts, but just to have that little thumbnail and to talk about how they work in concert or complement each other, I suppose,
absolutely.
As part of adding that strategic value.
Yeah. No, I certainly can, and always difficult to do this without my usual visual diagram, so you kind of have to imagine. But again, you're quite right, Beth. Gone are the days of saying, you know, I'm a community planner versus I'm a policy planner. And that really is the way of these two worlds. Community action planning, very much about practical things, very much about now, very much about the practical business of getting the work done, whether it's a housing program or fixing up the streets or a transportation program and so on. But the argument goes, certainly in the action planning process, is that with each practical intervention, there is a strategic agenda. Now, that agenda we can define in all sorts of different ways that has a different time scale. For example, in community action planning, one of the practical issues is to access shelter, access services and utilities, at least for the poorest communities. The strategic aspect of that and the much longer-term way of building up livelihoods and sustaining it all is in order for low-income people to access resources, which means removing constraints to doing that. And most of those constraints are there as a result of discrimination, not necessarily overt discrimination of age, gender, ethnicity, whatever it might be, income. And many of those are actually built into our laws, as it were. So there we are accessing shelter, which is relatively practical. You know, it means building houses. That's what that means, and making sure there's enough water lines in and all the rest of it. Accessing resources that sustain all of that so that people can build their own shelter, manage their own shelter, is, of course, a much longer-term issue that gets us to dealing with constraints and so on. Through community action planning, the practical agenda is to solve problems. There's no getting away from that. It's no use sitting in a community meeting, as I was not long ago, and talking about participatory processes that empower communities. And the guy at the back of the room puts up his hand and says, yeah, but my roof is leaking. And I remember the facilitator saying, yes, we're not worried about roofs at the moment. We're talking empowerment here, completely alienating the community groups as such. So CAP is about problem solving, whereas strategic action planning is about rights. It's about entitlements. It's about discrimination, as I say again, rights to land, access to essential resources and the like. Community action planning is about plans, projects, programs, which leads us to strategic action planning, which is about policies, making sure that standards are affordable, how they're integrated into legislation, the institutional reforms that may be required in order to enable all that to happen, back into partnerships. Again, a very much bigger agenda. I think at the bottom of the sort of whole ladder, at the top of the ladder, I don't know which end of the ladder I'm usually on here, is that with strategic action planning, let me put it another way. With community action planning, very often, because of the speed in which we have to work to solve problems, we're usually dealing with symptoms. The housing is poor, fix up the housing, perfectly reasonable. The pathways are getting flooded and very difficult to access as a result of whatever happens, fix up the pathways, as it were. The question with strategic action planning is, what are the primary causes that induce the bad housing? Right? So what is it that we need to tackle at the same time in order that we can sustain the practical interventions that we make? And we may find a whole series of things, some of the primary causes. Reducing dependency thinking, for example. Creating a sense of ownership of place, and not just of the problem, but of the solution as well. Making sure there's organizational capacity. Dealing with issues of poverty and vulnerability. Again, much bigger agendas. And it goes back to the very first question you asked, which is precisely why we suddenly very quickly get into a debate about, well, wait a minute, this is not about about architecture. So I talk a lot to architects and urban designers. And this gets us off architecture again. They say, well, does it, doesn't it? Do you really care as such? So I think, you know, at the bottom line, it's dealing with some of the primary causes, reducing vulnerability. It's ensuring that there is a program that manages some of the constraints that get in the way of actually achieving longer-term goals. Constraints, as I mentioned, to accessing resources, but also program constraints. We're always facing constraints that are institutional, financial, technical, and so on. Some of these are clearly a context for our work and have to be worked towards in the long term. And, you know, that becomes a strategic agenda as such. So that very much is relationship. Now, my final thing on that is that I tend to start on the ground. I start with community action planning and lead up to the strategic action planning rather than the other way around. In other words, in principle, I'm saying I think good policy derives from good practice. We can unravel what's going on in the streets of the everyday and say, if we're talking about enabling policies, then how can we support what's going and improve on it? Of course, we can't just accept it. I'm not romanticizing the community thing. But that's quite different from saying we've got a very elegant policy. Now let's look for practical ways of applying it, as it were. And, of course, the world of policy and practice is divided by those who do policy and those who do practice, which is why I talk about the developed practitioners, I like to call everybody, sitting in the middle between community action planning and strategic action planning.
Mm-hmm. Very much diving into that.
I can give you another quick month's lecture on that one.
Well, last question before we open it up to everyone.
Well,
I want to touch on this wonderful concept you bring into the book, Nabil, called backward reasoning, which I think is, again, so many practical things in this book. If you don't walk away with, you know, a list a mile long. But if you could touch on that, what does that really mean in terms of the practice? And could you just explain that a little bit?
Absolutely. Two aspects to it, really. I mean, reasoning backwards. I mean, one could also say reasoning from the ground, as it were. I think it was Richard Sennett, the anthropologist, who talked about reasoning from touch, which is another way of talking about it. And in the book, yes, the example of the buffalo is a really great one. We were talking about a community center. If I can just do an anecdotal example here. One was built, unused, sat there, unbelievable. One room was called theory room. No one knew quite what this was. This was in Sri Lanka, but it doesn't matter. Meeting room, but people there don't meet in the way that it was arranged, and so on and so forth. But there was clearly a need to mobilize community. And I had spotted, as I was talking to one family, this rather droopy-eared buffalo called Betty sitting in the background. And I was intrigued, partly because it was an urban setting. I don't see urban buffaloes as such. And there was a discussion about where it came from, and it was donated by an NGO, one to every six families, and there's all sorts of wonderful advantages to the buffalo and the resources it gives and so on. And that immediately sparked off to me an opportunity to organize community around. And so, again, we got, you know, the six buffaloes, six different groups of families who became the beginnings, at least, of a community-based organization. Their need for a community center was almost, to an extent, an urban farm, not, you know, the kind of center that you and I might think of. And in that farm, of course, there were great advantages to pooling the resources to feed the buffaloes. Buffalo curd was sold off to tourists. The dung was dried for fuel. Some of it was turned into mosquito repellent. They had wonderfully sophisticated ways of doing it with adding herbs so it didn't smell too much. The curd was sold in little pots, so we set up a little pottery plant to make pots, as it were, that also supplied the markets. The pots were covered traditionally with a little tapestry that was embroidered, all sorts of things. So what I'm saying, we reasoned backwards from the buffalo, right back into what made sense as a community center. I'm just having a sip of water here. So that's the first thing. It's reasoning from the bottom up. The second is about process. And here again, my voice is croaking out, I'm afraid, Beth, but don't worry.
No, you sound great. You take a sip of water, not a problem.
That's fine. It's very much, reasoning backwards has an impact then on process. And tradition, as I mentioned, we go from survey, analyze, plan, implement. Reasoning backwards is, I've done something, part of the action science thing. What does it tell me about the next step I can do? How does that lead me to a bigger plan, and so on? So it's reasoning backwards from the event, from touch, as it were. And again, as I say, that's very much a part of the action science routine. I like to kind of caption it by really saying, again, part of the action science routine, you know, we're usually quite used to, or at least taught, at least I was, that I've got to finish my thinking before I start doing. And we all know that's nonsense, because if you're writing a book or doing a program, the actual process of writing tells you something about your thinking. You know, and so I reason backwards from touch, from my pen and my paper, to what's in my mind, whether it makes sense to anybody else, and so on. And so in the context of planning, I say, well, let's think too much before we start doing, but don't do too much before you stop and reflect on it. And that two-way thinking and doing thing, of course, is familiar to us all, but somehow still not mainstream in practice.
Wonderful. That is a terrific way to capture that. I think it really resonates with a lot of us. It's very easy to write up a big document and say, here's how it's going to go, but then you go out in the field and it may be a totally different experience.
Absolutely.
You need to make those
Absolutely.
Changes. And so being conscious of that flexibility from the start is really key.
Thank you for joining us for this Public Forum Book Talk. We invite you to join us for future interviews with leading thinkers and practitioners in the field of stakeholder engagement. Visit our website at publicdecisions.com for a complete schedule and to register for upcoming events. For Public Decisions, I'm Beth Offenbecker.